This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, as part of our Lawyers You'll Like series, we'll talk with attorney Ann O'Berry.
Ann left a lucrative job in New York City to pursue death penalty work in the South. Today we'll hear from Ann about that work and her continuing efforts to protect civil liberties in Florida and throughout the South.
We'll find out more about the terrorism charges levied against activists at the NATO summit in Chicago.
Sounds like business as usual. Have a big protest, arrest some people from terrorism, scare the movement.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Michael, you told us a bit about the trial of Bradley Manning, and I understand that CCR is going to be involved on a different level with the case.
Well, CCR has been involved in some ways with Bradley Manning for a long time. We represent WikiLeaks and Julian Assange, and I and other CCR attorneys have been going to the Bradley Manning hearings down at Fort Meade, as I've reported on this radio show. One of the outrageous things about the hearings is that even documents that are not classified are not given to the public, are not given to the media. There's no way to get any of the court orders that the judge actually makes, even on such things as pretrial publicity. There's no way to get any of the motions, although now some defense motions are up, but government motions are not there. Government responses are not there. There's no transcript of the proceeding that we can get. There's one made, but no one has access to it, of the media or the public. You sit in the court, and you can't understand what's going on because you can't read any of the papers. So we now at the center for a number of months have been trying to insist to the court that these are public filings. Bradley Manning is being denied his right to a public trial, and the media and the citizenry is being denied their right to a public trial, which is a key part of ensuring that justice is done fairly.
Michael, are the documents being withheld in the name of national security, and also, is there precedent for this?
This is a court-martial. They apparently have different rules that they like to apply about letting the public know what's going on. Every court-martial is essentially an ad hoc tribunal. They're set up for the specific purpose of who they're going to try. They don't even have a clerk's office or a docket. And the judge has not said she's withholding because of national security. She simply is not giving the documents. No court orders, no motions, particularly of the government's, none of the replies or briefs, and no transcript. And there's also a lot of off-the-record hearings that we have no access to. So this, unfortunately, this seems to be a matter of course, but here you are in the most important court martial probably in the century, conceivably, and the public and the media are not getting any of the materials.
There's an irony in this, given that Manning is on trial for the very reason that he made documents public, and in his hearings, things are being withheld.
Yes. In fact, you could argue that the entire proceeding is a justification for what Bradley Manning allegedly did, that this entire country is going down some huge secrecy drain, even with documents that the judge doesn't even claim are national security documents, and they're not giving them to us. So what we did a few weeks ago is we filed some letters with the judge saying we want access. The Reporters Committee on Free Press filed a letter with 47 major newspapers saying we want access. Everything's been denied. So now we are going to the next level of the military appeals, the Court of Military Appeals, and then we go to the Court of the Armed Forces and then presumably into federal court. I expect to win the case. So last week we filed papers on behalf of the Center for Constitutional Rights, WikiLeaks, Julian Assange, Jeremy Scahill, Glenn Greenwald, and Kevin Gozzola from Fire Dog Lake to say we as the public, we as journalists, we as the attorneys for WikiLeaks should have public and open access to these records. The question is, what will that court do with it? It's the mid-level military court. I don't know. But we do know that when you get to a civilian court, which is the Court of the Appeal for the Armed Forces, that we probably have a better shot.
Yeah, I would agree with that, Michael. I had no success in these military tribunals. And I just recalled what Judge Damon Keith said, that democracy dies behind closed doors. There's a First Amendment right that we all have to see these documents. I hope your prediction is right and that we eventually get them.
We will get them. I mean, ultimately, the First Amendment is really strong here. Every federal court has said you have a right to these documents. There's no way we're not going to get them. So I'm optimistic. It's just taken months to get documents we should have contemporaneously or but with the trials. We have hearings coming up. Again, June 6, 7, 8, we have hearings at the Bradley Manning case. There's been papers filed. No one has public access to those papers.
Is there a tangible loss to you because we haven't got that?
Yes, because I think a couple of things. One is the public sits there in ignorance. The media sits there in ignorance. And therefore, if you've noticed, the coverage of the Manning trial is not terrific. There's not a lot of media there. One reason is you can't understand it, and it's boring. You can't read the papers. So even if they didn't go to the trial, a person from the media could at least read the papers and write a story. So it's actually had tremendous harm.
It's also dampening to any possibility of public outcry and renewed activism in the Manning case. And that, at this point, is a dangerous thing.
No, I think that's right. I mean, here's a man who many people, including me, consider a major hero for what he was able to do here. And he should be being lauded like, you know, Daniel Ellsberg is today. And he's not. And people should be concerned about what's happening to a 22-year-old soldier who saw what was going on in Iraq and said, this has got to stop.
Michael, you mentioned the writer Kevin Gostola, who we interviewed recently about his new book. What has his role been in covering the Manning case?
Well, Kevin has been one of the most stalwart journalists. He works for Fire Dog Lake. He wrote the book Truth and Consequences with Greg Mitchell from The Nation. We've interviewed them both on this show. They have been remarkable reporters for what the day-to-day goings-on are at the Bradley Manning case. And he will continue, I think Kevin will continue to cover the Manning case. He is one of the lead plaintiffs in this case to try and get the documents. Because as he says, how do you understand what's going on without the documents?
This is a shout-out to an anonymous person on behalf of Michael and Heidi and myself. A very lovely listener sent us a very fine book on Che Guevara because of the book, I guess, that Michael and I did, and sent us a beret and some other information, and we don't know how to thank her except on the air to say, you know who you are, and we're very grateful to you. We wish you good luck.
And I think she wanted a copy of the Hell No book, or the Che book, or one or the other, or both. I think the Hell No book, but if
write us your address, and we'll get you copies of anything you want.
And she wrote a lovely long note thanking us for the Che book, thanking us for Law and Disorder. So here's the shout-out with Smith and Heidi. Thank you again.
Heidi, the National Lawyers Guild has sent out a letter over your signature to Secretary of State Hillary Clinton regarding the massive widespread hunger strikes by Palestinians being held in Israeli prisons. What are you trying to accomplish?
Basically, Michael, we're asking that this government insist that the Israeli authorities abide by their international obligations, respect international humanitarian and human rights laws, and implement the concessions they've agreed to in good faith and to do so publicly.
How many thousands of prisoners were on hunger strike and how many and for how long?
There were approximately 2,000 Palestinian prisoners who literally put their lives on the line to protest widespread and illegal practices of administrative detention, as well as really horrendous living conditions and ill treatments that they were subjected to at the hands of Israeli prisons.
So you mean they were picked up, not charged with anything, kept in prison, many of them in solitary confinement?
Exactly.
With no trials?
Yep, based on secret evidence, no charges, no trial, as you said.
No visitors?
Exactly. And Human Rights Watch, Michael, said that, I'm just going to quote here, the idea that you can lock up hundreds of people at any given time, and over the year, hundreds and thousands of people without any due process rights, really turns human rights law on its head.
Now, are any of these people children?
Yes, Michael. They're arresting children. I mean, they're not discriminating in terms of who's being held. This isn't the first time we've had a mass Palestinian prisoner hunger strike. It is imperative that this country listens to the voices of these prisoners and takes really strong action to protect their fundamental rights.
Yeah, one suggestion I would make with respect to strong action is stop funding the Israeli government to facilitate doing this in the amount of over $1 billion a year.
Over $3.1 billion a year in military aid. And I agree with you. Michael, two cases we've discussed in the recent past have included updates on the National Defense Authorization Act and Chris Hedges' lawsuit and wiretapping. each of these has something in common. What is that?
Well, there's been a lot in the news about two recent cases. One was Chris Hedges' case, along with Chomsky and others, holding unconstitutional a section of the National Defense Authorization Act. And the other is the grant of certiorari, or the grant of review in the Supreme Court, of an ACLU case concerning warrantless wiretapping and the warrantless wiretapping law that many of us believed it was unconstitutional when Bush did it, is unconstitutional now that Congress has passed a law and Obama is doing it. And one of the questions that's raised is, what is it about these two cases that makes them interesting apart from the substance? And the key issue in these cases is not just the substance of whether the NDAA is unconstitutional or whether warrantless wiretapping is unconstitutional, but whether there's any right of people to challenge the unconstitutionality of those laws. The Hedges case was really interesting because here you have a broad statute, the National Defense Authorization Act. Chris Hedges, Chomsky, and others go into court and they say, well, we're afraid to do some interviews with people we normally talk to. We're afraid to do some of our writings because we don't know how that law is going to be applied. Will we be subject to being taken in as enemy combatants? Will we be subject to being indicted for this law? Are we violating the law if we do it? And in that case, the U.S. government came in and they said, we refuse to say that people like Hedges and Chomsky won't be covered by the law. As a result of that, the judge said, you, Hedges, Chomsky et al., have a right to challenge this law, what we lawyers technically call standing, because you might be injured by this law. What you're undertaking is chilled, is basically pushed back by this law.
I just want to interject, Michael. Hasn't it been held that when a so-called chilling effect is created, that in and of itself is unconstitutional?
It certainly can be. But let's say there's a law against, can make up any law, and I can come into court and say, it chills me to do that. You can't just make it up. But in this case, we have serious journalists, serious writers, serious people who are out there as public spokespeople saying that what we're doing might violate the law as it's broadly stated on the books.
Michael, remember what Chris Hedges was saying. You can pick me up and you can hold me forever for associating with people that you don't want me to associate with. I go interview somebody, you don't like it, you can stick me away forever.
So these people came into court, like as Michael is saying, and said, we're chilled by this law. This law could actually affect what we're doing. Now, it's similar in the wiretap case. In the wiretap case, none of us really know whether or not we were wiretapped. The center has a case saying we represent Guantanamo people, we're warrantlessly wiretapped, we talk to them all the time. We don't actually know that, but it's reasonably likely that we are wiretapped. We came into court and said it's reasonably likely that we're wiretapped. In our case, we had a different court. The court dismissed it, saying you have to actually show that you're wiretapped. In the ACLU case, they came in with a number of other people, journalists, lots of other people, who said, we do lots of work in foreign countries. We interview all kinds of people in foreign countries. And we think that we may be wiretapped and our work is being chilled like this. We have to also, just like the center has to do, we have to fly to Europe to interview our clients because we're afraid of having phone calls. So both cases at their core have the question of who can bring the case. Are they affected directly by the National Defense Authorization Act, as Hedges says, or are they people, can they litigate wiretapping, as the clients in the ACLU case say? Now, in both cases, in the NDAA case, that case is sure to be appealed to the circuit court, which will decide whether Hedges and Chomsky, et cetera, at all have a right to bring that case, whether they have, quote, standing. And what's interesting is the wiretap case of the ACLU, the Supreme Court just took review of that. Now, that's not really good, because the ACLU actually won the right to challenge the law in the lowest district court. And it said that those people that they brought in do have standing, the chilling effect is sufficient, etc. The government then took the case to the Court of Appeals. The Court of Appeals split on the issue 6-6 here in New York. That meant it affirmed the lower court judgment. The ACLU could go ahead with this case. Then, of course, the Supreme Court got into the act, got in, and is now going to hear that case next year in the fall in Washington, D.C. And the question will be, will they uphold the right of the people who claim they will be chilled, who assert they will be chilled, reasonably, and on my view have a reasonable basis for saying so, to challenge a law, even though they can't point to a paper saying, yes, we have been wiretapped. So both cases, while ultimately good, interesting, substantive cases, will rise or fall on whether
The people bringing those cases have the right to bring those cases. It's a nasty, dirty part of being a lawyer in this country, which is that the government can do all kinds of secret things to you. You can know they're roughly doing them to you, but you can't go into court to challenge them unless you have it down in a piece of paper that says from the government, we're wiretapping you or we'll arrest you under the NDAA.
Today we want to bring you some coverage about NATO and particularly the arrests that happen in Chicago for those protesting the NATO summit. Last week, as many listeners may know, more than 100 protesters were arrested at the summit in Chicago. Five activists were charged with terror-related crimes. Two were accused of attempted possession of explosives. Three were accused of conspiracy to commit terrorism, material support for terrorism, and possession of explosives. Is there any basis for these charges? Were people just entrapped? Are these increased efforts, which we've seen all over the country, to label peaceful protest as illegal or as terrorist activities? Today we'll talk to Sarah Gelsomino with the People's Law Office in Chicago, who said three of these activists were set up by government informants who had planted the explosives.
Welcome, Sarah, to Law and Disorder.
Thank you for having me.
Once again, we're seeing felony terrorism charges against individuals attending a national special security event, in this case, the NATO summit in Chicago. Can you tell us briefly what happened?
Sure. This whole saga began last Wednesday night. The National Lawyers Guild of Chicago learned that around 11:30 at night, a home in the Bridgeport area had been raided by the Chicago Police Department. At least we believe it to be the Chicago Police Department. People were concerned because several people had gone missing and we couldn't find them. What's important to realize, too, is this raid was completely unprofessional from the beginning, and it was a six-unit apartment building, and the police actually entered four apartment units. One, where they ended up making arrests, but three other apartment units were just neighbors, just people. Police removed them from their apartments, detained them, interrogated them, and then, without consent or a warrant, went in and searched their homes. And those three apartments, the police have never even tried to justify the entry of those homes at all. The fourth apartment, where they ended up making arrests, when they first went in, the police refused to show a warrant. They later arrived with what was allegedly a warrant, although a questionable one from the witness reports. And those people who had disappeared from the apartment were missing for a long period of time. The National Lawyers Guild frantically searched for them throughout Thursday, calling every police station we could imagine. And when that didn't work, going higher up in the levels of the city government, we called the superintendent's office, we called the corporation, assistant corporation counsel's office, trying to get some information as lawyers looking for our clients about where our clients were being held. And we couldn't find them. The city refused to acknowledge that they had them in custody, that they had made any arrests whatsoever, and also refused to acknowledge that they had made any raid in that neighborhood. So it wasn't until 4 p.m. the day after they were taken into custody that we were able to locate them and eventually get in as lawyers to see them at the Organized Crime Division of the Chicago Police Department. After that point, over the next day or so, six of the nine individuals were released without any charges whatsoever after being held for over 30 hours, a good part of that time shackled at their feet and handcuffed to a wall. And then there were two additional people who were also arrested, and those are the two people who haven't been seen since they were arrested in the raid and who we now believe were working for the police department as a part of this investigation. We believe that they infiltrated Occupy Chicago over a month ago.
Sarah, I want to talk about this because we've seen this very pattern for at least the last two or three national special security events, and the Guild came forward and actually issued a press release with its suspicion that these were infiltrators, undercovers, and in one case issued a photograph. Why did you do that?
Well, for a number of reasons. You know, we have been unable to get any information at all from the city about our clients, about the allegations, about this alleged investigation. And as a result, we've already mounted our own investigation as criminal defense attorneys in this case. You know, I wear kind of two hats here, one as a member of the National Lawyers Guild and one as a criminal defense attorney. And as a criminal defense attorney, we have a duty to vigorously defend our client and to have and to mount an investigation to do so. And since the time that we, you know, began to investigate our clients and where they were and why this raid happened, members of Occupy Chicago have been coming forward very concerned about the two people who we believe were working for the police department or passing information along to the police department. We don't know in what capacity that was because we haven't been told, but we do believe they were somehow communicating with the police department.
Sarah, what were the charges against the people that you're representing, and how do you think the informants were involved in this?
Well, the people that I'm among a group of defense attorneys representing are charged with terrorism, conspiracy to commit terrorism, material support of terrorism, and possession of an explosive or incendiary device, all very serious charges, and we believe very sensationalized charges and politicized charges. In fact, the only information we have about the investigation in this case is the proffer that the state's attorney read to us in court and has given us a copy of, and just about the very beginning of that proffer, it reads that these defendants are all anarchists, which is very concerning to us. You know, just the mere fact that they hold a political belief is not cannot be used against them as evidence of a crime in this country. There are also the two other individuals who are facing terrorism charges. They're not being charged along with the three. They're not being alleged to have been part of the same conspiracy, but they're also facing various terrorism charges. And we also believe that the same informants were working with the police and were part of the investigations, which led to the charges against those two individuals.
What substance is there to these charges of conspiracy to do something terroristic? What do they have on them?
Well, right now we have no idea what they have on them. They have yet to come forward with any evidence whatsoever. We haven't even seen the search warrant or the affidavit for the search warrant. We know nothing except for the very sensationalized allegations in that proffer. You know, and they allege various statements made by our clients and that they had various weapons in their possession. And they also are alleging, as is very common in these kind of charges that we see before national special security events, that they were involved in making of Molotov cocktails.
We've seen the Molotov cocktail accusations years ago in D.C. We saw it in the Twin Cities during the last RNC. Later it comes out these were household objects ascribed with evil intent. As you say, it's part of a rhetoric, heavy-handed, really smear campaign against protesters.
Yes. Yeah, and you know, the state's case will never be as strong as it is right now when they have not yet come forward with any evidence whatsoever. All they've made is these allegations, which have yet to be substantiated. So as we've seen in these other NSSE cases and in other terrorism cases my office has worked on, we fully anticipate that when the evidence begins to come forward, that the holes in the case will be exposed. The state just won't be able to prove these allegations that they've raised against the client.
Sarah, talk a bit about the high bail in these cases. $1.5 million?
It's very, very high. And actually, the prosecutors asked for a $5 million cash bond. They would have to put forth the entire $5 million in order to get out after we argued in mitigation. And against that request from the prosecutors, the judge refused to give the prosecutor what they asked and instead imposed this $1.5 million D-bond, meaning they would have to post 10% of it, which is still $150,000 is an enormous amount of money. These individuals are from very, you know, average American families. They don't have the resources to post that kind of money, and their supporters certainly don't have the resources to be able to come up with that kind of money for them. So they certainly will be spending a very long time in Cook County Jail awaiting trial in this case.
You know, in 2000 at the RNC in Philadelphia, we had $1 million range bails for Peter Sellers of the Ruckus Society, a local individual who police perceived were so-called leaders. Mm-hmm. This seems to be yet another tactic in the police arsenal against protesters to set such high bail that they have no chance of making that.
Yeah, and it's certainly, you know, just another part of this playbook and their campaigns of fear and intimidation that we see before all of these NSSEs, you know, really trying to make examples of individuals in order to deter other people, other activists, other political people from organizing and demonstrating. Another individual who was charged with a felony appeared in court the other day. Also, we've had a handful of felonies, although the majority of people arrested have been released either without charges or with misdemeanor charges or city tickets, but we've had a handful of felonies. And this gentleman is a journalist, an independent journalist, who was in town filming the footage of the protests. And he is being alleged to have committed an aggravated battery against a police officer. His bond was set at $250,000. That is an enormous bond for an aggravated battery. I don't even believe he has, you know, any kind of major background that would add to that. You know, it was clearly punitive. He was clearly being linked in with the other people who are facing more serious charges in that courtroom who are also arrested associated with the NATO protest. It was absolutely appalling to us to see that this independent journalist is now also going to be spending all of this time in Cook County Jail because his bond is just so unreachably high.
We're speaking with attorney Sarah Gelsomino. She's with the People's Law Office and the National Lawyers Guild. Sarah, you said before that the state's case against these people will never be as strong as it is right now. I think the effect of it, and I wanted to ask you what you think, but the effect of these sensationalized political charges of terrorism have been to keep participation of your average citizen in Chicago who wants to come out in the street and demonstrate against NATO, and the effect of it has been to minimize people's participation because you scare the pants off of them if they think they're going to get hurt or arrested if they go out into the street. Has that been your observation?
Well, we did have very vibrant demonstrations throughout the city this past week, but I do know that as I've been around town during this past week, many people have approached me with concerns. People are very afraid, particularly people in the Occupy movement, because they now feel so violated. Someone said to me, you know, Occupy is about bringing people together and linking movements for social change. And we weren't doing anything wrong. And now they feel that they've been targeted really for just trying to make some positive social change in the world. And so, yes, I have heard it from many people. People are afraid. They don't know who to trust. They don't know how to move forward. And that's very alarming.
Sarah, I want to remind our listeners that this case marks the first time that state prosecutors have used the Illinois terrorism law to prosecute individuals. And at the 2000 RNC, the so-called RNC 8 marked the first time that state terrorism laws were brought against individuals. Pattern here.
It seems so. Can't comment on the reasoning behind that or why the state's attorney has decided that this is how she wants to proceed in this case. But It is an alarming pattern that states are turning to terrorism charges in these kinds of cases, you know, not even just, you know, choosing to prosecute people with serious felonies, but really upping the ante in terms of demonizing them and different movements.
This is Michael Ratner speaking. I have one question about the pretrial detention here after the arrest. And the image you gave was of people being chained to the wall or something in a station house for 36 hours. That sounds completely medieval to me, apart from the fact you're supposed to arraign people within 24 hours and not chain them to walls. What was that about?
Well, here, the police have 48 hours to
in Chicago.
To bring charges against someone in Illinois. But we had major concerns, particularly for these last three, that they were in custody for a full 48 hours before they were charged. We were not informed of those charges until several hours later.
Yeah, and why were they chained to the wall? I don't understand it.
Well, you know, neither do we. Again, there were nine people arrested, plus these two people who were working for the police. When those nine people were brought to the Organized Crime Division, they were held isolated in different cells and were shackled at their feet and handcuffed to a wall. When we finally got National Lawyers Guild attorneys in to see them at around 5 o'clock the day after they were taken into custody, our attorneys came out absolutely appalled, saying that each of them was shackled at their feet even during the time that they met with the attorney. Up until that point, they had not permitted, actually at no point were they permitted to make a phone call. Despite numerous requests for attorneys, they had not been afforded the opportunity to have an attorney. And remember, this is at the same time that that the National Lawyers Guild was calling and calling and calling and trying to locate our clients. They were on the inside asking for us, and we were not permitted. They were not permitted to contact us, and we were unable to find where they were. It's very concerning behavior and really disappointing behavior.
What is the movement in Chicago going to do next? What are you lawyers going to do next?
We had over 100 arrests here in Chicago over the past week, and we have over 70 people who have sustained some pretty serious injuries from the police. The National Lawyers Guild chapter has our work cut out for us. We have been staffing a 24-hour hotline throughout the week and compiling all of this information so that we can now provide criminal defense representation to everyone who's facing charges. And that's what we're going to be doing. We're connecting everyone with a guild lawyer, and it's actually been great here in Chicago because so many lawyers have come forward who aren't necessarily associated with the guild, but who have come forward in solidarity with the demonstrators and say they want to volunteer their time to represent people. So we have a really great community of lawyers here who will be representing everyone who was arrested. And, you know, as to those facing terrorism charges, we will continue to advocate for them and, you know, defend them.
You make us very proud of you and the Guild.
Well, thanks. Sarah. I need that, guys. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Sarah.
Thank you, Sarah.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
You'll Like series, we're joined today by attorney Ann O'Berry. She's the vice president of the Southern Region of the National Lawyers Guild. While in law school, Ann served as a director of the Women's in Prison Project at Rikers Island in New York City, where she taught incarcerated women how to prevent termination of their parental rights. Ann clerked for federal judges in New York, New Jersey, and Pennsylvania, including the famous Judge A. Leon Higginbotham Jr. of the Court of Appeals. She taught civil rights and South African apartheid law at the University of Pennsylvania, and then she taught race and the law at St. Thomas University Law School in Miami, Florida. In the last 12 years, Ann has served as counsel at a Florida law firm that specializes in class action litigation, particularly with environmental and privacy rights. Ann joins us today to talk more about her work as a people's lawyer. Ann, welcome to Law and Disorder.
Thank you. Happy to be here.
As a relatively new guild member, we've been excited to learn about your history as a lawyer in the South. We wanted to start by asking you about the publication, The Law Only as an Enemy, that you've written. Can you tell us a bit about that and how it's informed your work?
Yes, I co-authored that with Judge Leon Higginbotham, who unfortunately passed away. But he was my mentor. I worked with him on a project regarding race in the law. He was on the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Third Circuit during that time, but he was also teaching at the University of Pennsylvania Law School, along with NYU and Harvard and many other places. And he had a long-term project on race in the law. We were working on his book, and in the process, we have published various chapters out of that book. His original book was In the Matter of Color, which won a lot of awards, and this was a follow-up to that book. And the focus was basically on issues of powerlessness in terms of the law and the legal structure. And so we did a lot of historical research regarding racism and the law back in pre-Civil War Virginia. We focused on Virginia because it was a paradigm for slavery, basically, and the slave laws that were in place. We wrote an article for publication. It was published in the University of North Carolina Law Review, The Law Only as an Enemy. Basically, we analyzed the different treatment in Virginia, in pre-Civil War Virginia, depending on your status. If you were a free white person or a free black person or a slave, depending on your status, you were treated differently by the law. And what we found was, as an overall theme, depending on what the race of the victim was, that would affect what your sentence would be. For example, if a black woman was raped, that was not considered a crime. If a white woman was raped, that was considered a crime and was punishable by death. And also, if your status, if you were a black person and you stole something, you would be put to death. And it was ironic for the slave owner, because if their slaves were put to death, they had to be compensated by the state because they were considered property. So I guess what I would say about that research is that it certainly still impacts what happens today, believe it or not, many, many years later. I found that when I was doing death penalty work, for example, I did research with Professor Michael Radelet at the University of Florida, who's a sociology professor there, and he had been doing research on race and the law and how the race of the victim impacts how you are treated by the criminal justice system. And what we found was we actually went to four counties in Florida, Volusia County, St. John's County, Flagler County, and Putnam County. And what I did was I went through every single criminal case in those four counties for a certain time period. It might have been 5 or 10 years, and looked at what happened to the people that were charged. And what we found all along the way is that if the victim was black, the crime was treated less seriously than if the victim was white. If there were manslaughter, for example, if there were a killing of a child, if the child was black, the case would be treated as manslaughter. If the child was white, it was treated more seriously as a murder case. It went so far up the line as to go all the way up to whether they would seek the death penalty or not. And so I had believed prior to doing that research that what was the most significant factor was the race of the offender. But after doing this research, what we concluded is that that is a very important factor, but also the race of the victim is extremely important. They just simply treat African-American lives as less valuable than white people's lives.
And it's interesting because when I was in law school in Pennsylvania, I worked on a Baldus study going through all death-eligible case files since the time the death penalty was reinstated to look at aggravating and mitigating circumstances. And of course, we found similar things as you've described.
How did you get involved in death penalty work? And talk to us about what you do there and what you think about it.
Well, I'm not doing it now, but I started out, I was working at a firm in New York, which was a large, prominent Wall Street type firm. I'd gone there after law school, and the firm was known for its commitment to pro bono work. The name of the firm was Debevoise and Plimpton. And so I was, I guess what they call it, among some people, I was known as the pro bono queen because I did a lot of pro bono work while I was there. And the
That's great.
I was there for about 2.5 years, and the first pro bono case I did was a death penalty case We were representing Dalton Prejean from Louisiana. By the time I started working on the case, he'd already been through probably one round of direct appeals, post-conviction appeals, and we worked on his case for about 2 years, and unfortunately he was executed in May 1990. During that time that we worked on the case, he was up before the U.S. Supreme Court twice. Once, the first time, his case was up there on the issue of whether you could execute the mentally retarded, because we had evidence showing that he was mentally retarded. And the court ruled back then that it was okay. It was not unconstitutional to execute the retarded. And then separately, his case was held on the issue of whether you could execute juveniles. He was 17 at the time of his offense. And the court held at that time, yes, there's no problem, you can execute juveniles. So unfortunately, we went through I don't know how many rounds of death warrants, but as I said, in 1990, he was executed. And he was tried by an all-white jury. Dalton was black. The victim was white. The victim was a state trooper. There were not any issues of innocence in the case. It was more whether he should be executed or whether he should be allowed to serve out his life in prison. It was a very compelling case. Dalton was like a child, basically. And let's just say that along the whole entire process of his case was just a travesty from beginning to end. His attorney, his trial attorney, was drunk during the trial. The jury did not know that Dalton was retarded. In fact, they were told he was a smart kid. They didn't know he'd suffered horrendous abuse, that his mother had abandoned him when he was a child. Amazing mitigating circumstances that the jury never heard. I was so moved by that experience that I decided to give up my cushy job in New York and go do death penalty work full-time. So I ended up at the Federal Resource Center. It was a federally funded resource center doing death penalty work in Tallahassee, Florida. And I did that work from 1991 until 1996, when Congress defunded all the resource centers around the country. And then after that, I spent about a year representing women who were seeking executive clemency. It was called the Battered Women's Clemency Project in Florida. And I thought that working on cases where the clients were not going to be executed would be a little bit easier to deal with, but it wasn't, emotionally speaking. Just to meet these women who were literally fighting for their lives and defending themselves against horrendous abuse by their spouses, and who ended up, in some cases, doing life without parole. And so we were trying to get them out on clemency, and we were actually successful in getting a number of women out. So I'm not doing death penalty work at this time, but that was probably the most significant legal work that I've done.
Have there been changes in the application of the death penalty? I mean, the word better is not the word I would use, but are we making progress? I know in some other states outside of the South, we're making some progress on abolishing the death penalty. But in Florida, yes. Georgia, Mississippi, any shifts, any Louisiana, any shifts, any changes?
Well, I will say one thing regarding, just going back to Dalton's case. I mean, more recently, the U.S. Supreme Court did rule that it is unconstitutional to execute people who were juveniles at the time of the offense, and unconstitutional to execute people who were mentally retarded. Florida has gotten on board with that in terms of legislation. So there is a process now for determining whether someone is mentally retarded. I see some improvements. I would say that the example of Troy Davis, unfortunately, is an example of how we have not come very far. I've seen both improvements, and I would say primarily in public opinion. We're seeing a shift in public opinion away from the death penalty because people realize, number one, there's a grave risk of executing innocent people. Number two, it's horrendously expensive to have a death penalty, and many states can't afford it. It will bankrupt a county who's trying to defend one death penalty case that's going through the system. So I'm seeing a shift away from the death penalty, and I really believe that in my lifetime, I'm 51, I believe that in my lifetime we will see the end of the death penalty in this country. I hope that's true. On the other hand, the laws, particularly on the federal level, have become much more difficult in terms of trying to persuade a court to hear your case after you've gone through one round of appeals. The procedural bars to bring in claims, even when you have very, very strong claims of actual innocence, they'll literally kick you out of court even if you're innocent, and it's just an amazing system we have where the courts will say, yes, you've got compelling evidence of innocence, but we're not going to hear your case.
It's emotionally trying to handle this kind of case. What got you through this period of time, and what motivated you?
I would say that what got me through was the victories. It was incredibly hard emotionally, and I have to say I admire the people that are still doing the work today, people who've been doing it for 20 years, 30 years. I don't know how they do it because it takes a piece out of you. It really does. It changes you doing this work. When you come to care for your clients, and if they end up being executed, I mean, there's just nothing worse that I can think of. But what got me through was the wins. When we would win, the sense of victory and justice, you feel like if you fight hard enough, maybe you can win. And I'm happy to say that in the cases that I worked on, where I was primarily the attorney responsible for the case, I don't believe that I had a single case that ended up with an execution. And so I poured my heart and soul into it. I would say that my personal life was non-existent, but it didn't matter to me because I was doing something that I believed in so fundamentally. And to be able to go to your client and say, you got to stay and you're going to live another day, and then ultimately for them to get off death row, there's just no greater feeling. And so what got me through was the successes and the support of the people that were doing the work. I mean, there was a tremendous camaraderie among the people that were doing this work.
But you're still doing political work, you're still doing legal work. Can you just talk about some of that?
Sure. Well, a lot of the work I'm doing now is actually, with the Guild. I'm the regional vice president for the Guild. As Heidi mentioned, I'm a relatively new member. I wish I had joined a long time ago, but the work that I'm doing with the Guild is just the most incredible work, and I'm just so happy to be doing it. And as far as, you know, actual lawyer work, presently I'm working with an attorney, Jim Green, who's a prominent civil rights attorney in West Palm Beach, kind of a legend down here, and I'm very fortunate to be working with him. He does a lot of civil rights, constitutional litigation. We represent people with disabilities, so we do a lot of work with under the ADA and also the Fair Housing Act. I also do some volunteer work with El Sol. It's a day laborer center in Jupiter, Florida.
Yeah, we wanted to ask you about that. That sounds really compelling.
It's great. My understanding is there are about 100 day laborer centers around the country, and the way this started was there was a large immigrant population that, for whatever reason, ended up in the Jupiter area, and it used to be that they would stand out on the street looking for day work. Contractors and what other people would come and pick them up and bring them to jobs. And there was a movement to get something more organized and something that would protect the workers and also be helpful for people who were hiring. So we had people in Jupiter who the neighbors were complaining about all these guys standing out on the street. So there was a consensus that they should figure out a system to have a better system for people getting hired for day work. Jill Hansen, who is the immediate past president of El Sol, she and her husband were two of the co-founders of El Sol. Sol Silverman, who is a longtime labor attorney, and so is Jill. She's a longtime labor attorney and actually was very involved with the Guild up in New York. Unfortunately, Sol passed away before El Sol opened, but the center, it provides legal support, cultural support, know your rights training. They feed everyone every day for breakfast and lunch. And it's basically a community center for the immigrant community. I would say primarily people from Central America, some people maybe from Haiti. And so I started volunteering there with Jill. She's the attorney for El Sol. We basically try to help people with whatever legal issues may come up. We see wage theft cases where people go to work for someone and then they don't get paid because perhaps they're undocumented and the employer thinks, well, I don't have to worry about it because they're not going to come forward to complain.
He has to worry about it if O'Berry's on the case, right? What do you do?
That's right. We contact the employer and we say, hey, we have somebody here who worked for you for however many hours on however many days and didn't get paid. And generally when the lawyer steps in, they'll back off. They'll come forward and pay. If they think they can get away with it, they will. But that's part of the beauty of El Sol is the employers come to El Sol and they register at the center and say, I need however many people to do X kind of work, whether it's landscaping or construction or housekeeping or whatever it might be. And then the people are sitting at the center waiting to see if jobs come in. It's a good way to keep track of making sure that these people are, you know, everybody signs in, so you know who the employer is, you know who the employee is, and it's, so they're better protected that way.
And we only have a few minutes left, but I wanted to end on preparations for the upcoming RNC in Tampa, and I know you've been very active in that. What do you expect to see?
We expect to see probably 10,000 to 15,000 protesters there based on past conventions. We expect to see, and we hope to see, many, many people coming to offer help doing legal observing. In terms of what we expect to see from law enforcement, well...
Tanks.
we expect to see all kinds of new toys. You know, we're seeing an increased militarization of the police around the country, and we know they've got tanks, tanks that you would see out in the field if you're fighting a war. I don't think they're going to have drones, but you don't know, because I guess it was a little bit more than their budget would tolerate. But
they wanted drones, didn't they?
Yeah, they wanted drones, and then I guess the Tampa City Council said, well, these are pretty expensive, so maybe we don't need the drones. But they've got a lot of things they're bringing out. I don't know if they're going to have sound cannons, you know, like the long-range acoustical device. They don't tell us what they're going to be using.
Let me ask you, we're just recovering from 2004, right? Wasn't there the FTA, Free Trade of the Americas stuff in Florida?
And there were multi-million-dollar judgments against the city of Miami, and you would think that these multi-million-dollar judgments would deter cities from doing the same kinds of things over and over again where they're suppressing people's First Amendment rights. But, I mean, we just saw Chicago shell out six-something million dollars in a settlement, and yet we're seeing it again with the NATO protests that just happened. And of course, every time we have these conventions or these large protest situations with special national security events, we see these ordinances. They pass these draconian ordinances where you can't have a string, you can't have a stick, you can't have a bottle, a glass bottle.
Well, at least they're letting us have string that's up to six feet in length now. And guns are allowed.
Yes, in Florida. The Florida legislature passed a law saying that the municipality's gun control laws can't be any more restrictive than the state law on guns. So if the municipality wanted to prohibit guns in Tampa for the RNC, basically they can't do it because of the state law. And the Tampa City Council tried to get some exception to that passed, and basically the governor said no, the legislature said no. So we have this bizarre situation where you can't have a stick or a glass bottle if you're protesting there, but you're welcome to bring your gun.
Yeah.
So, and this is all supposed to be for public safety. It's just ridiculous.
I wanted to take you back to 1986 when you went to NYU Law School. What were your expectations about going to law school? What would you recommend to young people today who are thinking about going to law school?
It's not much fun, but actually NYU was a great law school. It is and was a very progressive law school. And I'm really glad that I went there, so I'm making my little pitch for NYU.
What about going to law school generally in terms of having some effect on social justice? Are you glad you went?
Absolutely. I mean, I actually started out when I was a teenager, I thought I wanted to be a social worker. And then I came around to the idea that you could probably affect more change, maybe, on a broader level as an attorney. And I think that's been true, for me anyway. And I highly recommend law school. It's an amazing experience, and as an attorney, you have an opportunity to really make incredible changes in the system. We try anyway, and I think speaking for the Guild and the Center for Constitutional Rights, for example, I mean, those are two organizations that have had a profound effect on social movements in this country and securing rights for Americans.
And we're very, very fortunate to have you among our ranks. You're truly a fine people's lawyer. I look forward to working with you down in Tampa. And want to thank you for all the great work you've done over the years.
And we'll see you at the Guild Convention in Pasadena in
Guild
October.
Guild Convention, Tampa, and
what
working
fun.
Working with Absolutely. My son at Immokalee Work is all great.
Thanks so much,
well, thank
Ann.
You too. Thank
Take
you
care, Ann. Bye-bye.
Bye-bye.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.
The sounds return pure and easy.